This is a BBC Radio 4 archive edition of Alistair Cook's Letter from America.
Good morning. I've always thought of anniversary, the turn of the year, or literally the return of the year. I've always thought of it as a happy word. But there have been one or two anniversaries lately that considerably bruise the idea of an anniversary as a festive time. I'd say that 10 years ago, less, most Americans, asked to respond offhand to the prospect of 1992, the anniversary of Christopher Columbus limping ashore at San Salvador, would have looked forward to it as an all-American fiesta. But in the meantime, a literature of disillusion had been spawned. And when October 1992 arrived, there were very few fireworks, and from one end of the Americas to the other, many memorial parades, many trooping Indian tribes, observing the 12th of October as a day of mourning. What they were mourning was their experience, the native experience of the conquistadores, the conquistadors. The very name says conquest, and in the 15th century, the conquest by any European nation of a native society meant subjection, enslavement, rape, often torture, and suppression of the native religion. It took about four centuries for intending conquerors, the French and the British are the best examples, to have the sense to let the subject peoples keep many of their mores and all of their religions. The sudden revelation of all this last year in books and magazines and newspaper pieces can only mean that for a couple of centuries or so, the white man's settlement, conquest of the Americas, must have been very badly taught in the schools. The truths revealed last year were always true, but had been quietly relegated to the shadows, while the big spotlight was turned on the European, the white view of Columbus as a master sailor, an extremely courageous explorer, a remarkable commander, a visionary, and a devout Catholic, all of which he was. However, once the brutal side of the Spanish conquests became common knowledge, became in the past 2 years something of a publishing industry, it was not possible to say, well, too bad, let's forget that part, and on the great October day, let's enjoy, as John Adams recommended for the 4th of July, fireworks, parades, bands, and general rejoicing. In fact, when that Columbus Day was over, the governors and the mayors, not to mention members of Congress, furnished sighs of relief that the few riots and eruptions of violence happened in only two or three countries, and they were in Central and South America. Well, now, I have to say, I believe very many Americans, young and old, will be greatly relieved that the 22nd of November is over. Not from any fear this time of protest, marches, or riots, but relief from the sheer din of morbid nostalgia. The 22nd of November, 30 years ago, 1963, was, as everyone knows, the assassination of President Kennedy. If disillusion with Columbus was a publishing industry, two industries based in the life of John Kennedy have flourished and overwhelmed us this past month or two. One is what you might call the Camelot industry, the perpetuation and embroidering of the beautiful myth taken from the Tennyson poem of an ideal small nation whose shining hour was the time it was presided over by a brave young king. The other, a growth industry that gives no sign of stopping growing, is the Kennedy conspiracy industry. And to say much about it would only massage the sales representatives of that feverish specialty. Let me just say, I have no peculiar or privileged knowledge of the affair. I have fairly creditable credentials. I was there at the time. I practically wrote the next day's issue of the English newspaper for which I was at the time the chief American correspondent. I read every word of the Warren Commission's report, which, by the way, was a commission of able, inquisitive, and honourable men, none of them, so far as I know, crippled by a hobby horse. Subsequently, I read the early books and a summary of the, was it 1974, House Committee's renewed inquiry. And, of course, like everybody who was at the time a sentient adult, I have paid attention to most of the following reports and theories and revised versions. And I will say, I do not believe that the president was killed on the orders of the Kremlin, Fidel Castro, Lyndon B. Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover, Mao Zedong, Generalissimo Francisco Franco, Carrie Nation, or Dr. Crippen. I lean to the belief that a very forlorn, agitated, lonely psychopath named Lee Harvey Oswald did it without help or coaching. And as for the maze of motives that the conspiracy boys and girls would have you thread through, it seems to me that the likeliest is one small enough to seem trivial to the big apocalyptic revisionists, but big enough to have inspired some of the world's greatest literature, including Othello and Madame Bovary, namely Oswald's false suspicion, which his widow says plagued him at the time, that she adored Kennedy and was at the same time sleeping with an FBI agent. So far as I'm concerned, there's no more to say. About the mythical kingdom of Camelot, which during the run of the fanciful musical of the same name came to be merged with the fact of the Kennedy presidency, we can only say now it must show that nations, like individuals, have a constant yearning for leaders who are larger, more heroic than life. And John Kennedy and his wife arrived as something quite new in the history of the presidency, a beautiful young couple. I don't know of any other president's wife who was beautiful, and if we have to indulge a prejudice in favour of, say, Martha Washington and or Grace Coolidge, we can say for sure that neither of their husbands could be called handsome. So what was wrong about having a handsome young president with a beautiful wife? Nothing, except we went on from there to romanticize their public lives. The private life seemed blissfully right, a delusion that was not shared by the White House press corps. But in those days, one of the taboos that was observed and never talked about was a taboo against writing about the sexual peccadilloes of the president, if any. A White House butler who wrote, 50 years ago, a memoir of the presidents he'd served described President Harding as a ladies' man, but only in the opposite sense to his characterization of Teddy Roosevelt as a man's man. Fortunately for John Kennedy, the taboo against writing about or publicly disclosing the sexual habits of public men was still in force. If it had not been so, I doubt he'd ever have been able to run for public office. As it was, after the grim years of the Second War and the unexpectedly bitter ordeal of the Korean War and a stretch of government by late middle-aged men, it was a tonic thing to see a young, handsome president up there on his brilliant, frosty inauguration day saying, "The torch has been passed to a younger generation," even though all the equals he had to deal with were the old men of the recent wars. We readily embraced the glitter and charm and promise of a kind of chivalry in the presidency. This romantic hunger was so strong that when the ill-conceived and wretchedly executed invasion of Cuba failed miserably, and Kennedy said he was sorry for it, his popular standing in the polls went soaring. A journalist I know wrote movingly the other day about his boyhood view of Kennedy as a magical little guy on a black-and-white television set who, although he was a rich politician from Boston, I believed represented me and understood me. This boy enjoyed chanting over what he called the sing-song aphorisms of Ted Sorensen. He was the author of the Kennedy inaugural speech. "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask rather what you can do for your country." Well, my journalist, now I guess crowding 50 or so, wrote on this November 22nd, "Kennedy was the first great fraud of the postmodern era. He was the surprised and grateful object of a mass delusion. He came from a state where electing Irish politicians by fraud was an art form. His father was a bandit and a profiteer. JFK never won a majority in a national election. It seems likely that the election of 1960 was stolen for him by the Daily Machine in Chicago." That is, I think, almost certainly true. But as for the other judgments, they're too brutal. They are the cynical outcries of a disappointed sentimentalist. We should not now blame Kennedy for our misplaced romanticism. He brought to the presidency the energy of an optimistic spirit. On the initiative of the suggestion of a congressman from Wisconsin, he invented the Peace Corps. He got us deeply involved in Vietnam. In the early assertion of the civil rights of blacks, he did use the National Guard with, as he would have said, vigor, where Eisenhower had used it with reluctance. He had wit and a low-key gift of Irish blarney. He was disorganized and acted too often on impulse. He had no gift for cajoling and nudging and arm-twisting the Congress. He once called Congress the enemy. When he died, there were something like 90 bills that were dead or dying. Luckily, he was succeeded by Lyndon Johnson, no charmer, but the best con man who ever converted a political enemy, who got more than two-thirds of those bills through the Congress in the following 6 months. It's been remarked that when an American president dies, a halo descends on him and stays there with his memory. This is not true of McKinley. It's very true of Lincoln and Kennedy. The debates about their true worth still go on, or perhaps only about Kennedy. Lincoln has almost been sanctified, and the bad and arbitrary things about him are buried in his grave. Let it be so, once for all, with John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Good night.
That was Letter from America with Alastair Cook. You can find more Letters from America and thousands of other programmes for curious minds on the Radio 4 website.